When I moved to Boston nearly 4 years ago now, one of the first people to contact me was Dr. Krister Sersing, and we met at the faculty club of Harvard University and had lunch, and I met a man who has become a theological as well as a spiritual friend over these past 4 years. It's been our privilege as a congregation to be on Krister's support team for the last year. And as you know, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, Krister made the wonderful announcement that he soon will be teaching in Moscow in what formerly was a Communist Party university. And we're glad to be part of the team that will send him there. And so Krister asked tonight if this was a sermon or a report or a sermonic report or a reporting sermon. And I suppose it's any or all of those. And Krister will share with us a retrospect where he has been, prospect where he is going, and a little bit about his pilgrimage. But first, hear the word of the Lord. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Krister, we look forward to what God has to say to us through you tonight.
I deeply appreciate the privilege of being able to share with you during this missions conference. On Friday morning, I gave what I think is my last chapel talk at Harvard University in the Appleton Chapel. And I thought I would share some excerpts of that talk with you, exactly what I said to these Harvard students in chapel. As you know, Harvard has daily chapel. It's a tradition which began in 1636 and has continued ever since. It's the only Ivy League school which started with this tradition and has not given it up. And part of my responsibilities at Harvard as chaplain to international students is to be involved in that daily chapel. And let me just read some excerpts of this for you. From time to time, I am asked the question, why did you become a Christian? Why did you leave such an interesting and colorful religion as Hinduism with its mystical and philosophical outlook for Christianity? Why did this seemingly intolerant and imperialistic religion of Christianity attract you? Let me say, first of all, that in my spiritual gropings, I never thought of myself as leaving Hinduism or slouching towards Christianity. For one thing, I had no interest in Christianity. I was raised with the belief that all religions are valid paths to the spiritual life, though none of my Hindu friends and family thought much of Christianity or Islam. We were convinced that only Hinduism offered a path to spiritual perfection and divine self-realization through the disciplines of yoga and bhakti, while other religions were seen as fragmentary manifestations of the divine consciousness. Only the great gurus and swamis of the Hindu tradition attained that perfect God consciousness, which is the true end of religion. Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, Yogananda, Sivananda, Sai Baba and Muktananda surpassed all prophets, saints, and teachers of other religions. This I really did believe. Like all my Hindu friends and relatives, I believe that these gurus and swamis had perfectly realized their divine selfhood through the disciplines of yoga, non-attachment, and radical self-renunciation. That was the path to true holiness, so I thought. To be holy was to realize your own divinity, to actualize your divine selfhood through meditation and yoga. Holiness had virtually nothing to do with human relationships, being set apart for sacrificial service and reconciling love in human community. These are just distractions from the true ends of religion. The liberation of the soul is a liberation from all forms of personal existence. Salvation is deliverance from all forms of embodiment, even a heavenly body. Ultimate salvation is absorption in the ocean of being. Towards the end of my senior year in high school, an Indian classmate, Kusiyal Singh, now a medical doctor, he suggested that I begin reading the New Testament after I recounted to him a bizarre and rather terrifying experience. I was willing to go to any lengths to prevent the reoccurrence of that experience of terror, and so I complied with his suggestion. Singh was surprised to find out that he touched lepers and cared deeply about the common people. Why was he so generous to them? It dawned on me that he was doing this for no other reason than that he loved them. His conduct did not fit in with my conception of holiness and true religion. Clearly, Jesus was not trying to acquire merit. He was the bestower of blessing. I was surprised and fascinated by his claim that he had the power and the authority to forgive sins. Within my religious horizon, that was an impossibility. The grim and relentless law of karma, the basic Hindu principle. Karma rules out any possibility of forgiveness. Every person had to work out their own salvation through successive reincarnations until he or she attained perfection. Then one day it dawned upon me that moksha, that liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth, was an impossibility for me. The teachings of the Nazarene caused me to examine my attitude to Muslims, to lower caste Hindus, to the poor, as I thought about my pride and arrogance. I came from the wealthiest Hindu family in the town. My contempt for Muslims and lower caste Hindus, my evil thoughts, I could only conceive of a downward spiral of going lower and lower. I could not imagine rising above this, because I came to terms with human nature for what it was. I saw that there was no way out for me. Jesus' message of repentance and forgiveness was an appealing one. If what he said was really the case, that would be good news indeed. It would be the best possible news if it's really true that he had the power to forgive sins. To be free from the burden and crushing oppression of karma, to be forgiven of all sins, that was what my soul longed for. And so I would get into the cane fields after school to chant to Jesus the Gayatri Mantra, my guru's mantra, and a host of other Sanskrit mantras in the hope that he would come to me and show me the way. Then I would enter into the puja room, a room in our home that was set apart for the devotion to the Hindu deities. I would go into this room after purification, and I would offer incense to Jesus while reciting mantras to him after paying perfunctory homage to the images of Shiva, Krishna, and a host of others on the altar. The picture of Jesus was placed on a wall next to Guru's, not on the altar. One night after reading through John's Gospel, I came to believe that he is the Savior of the world, that his death had something to do with taking away the sins of the world as well as my own sin. I was convinced that he had the power to give me a new kind of life. I knelt and asked Jesus to forgive me of my sins and to become the Lord of my life. When I was through praying, I knew that I belonged to the Lord of the universe, that my sins were forgiven, and that all of this was possible only because of Jesus. Up to that point, I had never entered a Christian church. It was at the end of my final year in high school. But soon afterwards, Reverend Hamid, a former Muslim and the pastor of a house church, began to instruct me in the Christian faith as he prepared me for baptism. Shortly after my baptism, I shared the gospel with all the members of the household, my brothers and sisters, my grandmother, and I led all of them to Christ. In fact, my mother at that point was appointed to be the resident priestess of the largest Hindu temple in the Caribbean to give lectures on Hindu philosophy every Thursday night and to live there And I said to her, wait 2 weeks before accepting the appointment. And then I began to share the gospel with her, and then she came to me and said, she has decided to be a secret follower of Jesus and nobody would ever know. Today, she travels throughout many countries preaching and singing the gospel in Hindi. And she expects to come and visit me sometime in May. She has not seen our second child, who's 2.5 years old, and she wants to see this child before we move to Moscow. But interestingly, after the whole family came to Christ, the financial executor of the estate, my mother's oldest brother, who was our provider, he came to his own mother, to me, to all my brothers and sisters, and he said to all of us, let Jesus Christ take care of you. I am leaving. And from being the wealthiest and the most privileged family like that, we were disinherited, cut off, and I got a job, and for 3.5 years supported the family. And my dream of going to Oxford or Cambridge died. But God wonderfully opened new doors, and I ended up at Yale as an undergrad and finished a PhD at Harvard. But as I look back at my life, I am convinced that God had orchestrated all of these events to prepare me for a task that He had chosen for me. After I got a PhD, I never applied for any teaching position. People said, well, how were you called to the ministry? What drew you? How did you know? Ever since I gave my life to Christ, I had a prayer immediately after. I prayed for years, and I still continue to pray, that God would give me a passion for the lost, a passion to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, and a passion for the life of the mind, a passion for learning and understanding. And my desire has always been to bring all of the knowledge that I have acquired at the foot of the cross and bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, to the knowledge of Christ. It was in the spring of 1984 that I attended an ISI conference, International Students Incorporated, the mission organization with which I am connected, in Pennsylvania. And while I was there, I remember I got up on Good Friday morning, and there were 8 or 10 Chinese visiting scholars from the Harvard Yenching Institute who surrounded my bed and said, tell us about Holy Week. What is Holy Week all about? They were there for an Easter conference. And I began to share the gospel with them. And there I became convinced that God was calling me to a ministry to internationals. Later that year, I was commissioned by ISI and appointed to work at Harvard as a missionary to internationals. And then a little over a year later, the minister in the Memorial Church at Harvard University heard that I was going to do mission work at Harvard and invited me to join the staff of the church to carry out my ministry. And I have been doing that since, and about 5 weeks ago, that appointment was terminated. People ask me, well, what sorts of things you do as a minister to internationals, as a missionary at Harvard? Time does not permit to recount the nature of that ministry, but I'll highlight a few things. In the beginning of the school year, the Harvard International Office, they make me a part of their orientation program, and it is my task to address the incoming internationals at Harvard's orientation, to talk about religion in America. Over the last couple of years, they've become very concerned about cults, the Boston Church of Christ and other groups. And I give a half an hour session on cults and the religious resources of the university, at which point I talk about the evangelical churches in town, the focus program, and what's going on here. So this is a special opportunity that was opened up to me at Harvard to plug other groups that I wanted to see involved in international ministry. In fact, Friday night I was on the phone with one of the people in the office who had called me earlier and told me that a group of Russian school children 10 years old to 15 years old are coming on an exchange program for 10 days. And if I could help with finding families who know Russian to place these kids. So I said, we will take one. One of the things that I do also is participate in the orientation program of the Harvard Yenching Institute, which brings about 25 Chinese, Japanese scholars every year. These are distinguished scholars who come to Harvard to write a book. And I give them a lecture on the Christian foundations of Harvard, and give them a tour of the university, have them to a barbecue cookout, at which point I establish my relationship with them and then set up Bible studies for them during the course of the year. God has opened tremendous opportunities within the university because of this appointment which was made for me. Also, the fact that I did my graduate studies at Harvard helped in many of these connections. Somebody asked me, looking back on your ministry at Harvard, can you single out any particular incident which you could say, this was really worth your time, this justified your ministry here? Well, I thought of one event. I thought of an African student from Nigeria who was asked by the department after 6 years of doctoral studies to leave because he had failed his third year Greek and he had failed his German language requirement. And he had taken it a couple of times, and they thought that was enough. And I went to see every member of the New Testament department. I went to see the chairman of his committee. And I remember going into the dean of the Divinity School's office. He'd invited me, and we sat down, and we looked at his transcripts. And I made a case for him to several faculty. And I did all that I could. And then they decided that he should be kicked out. And this fellow would call me every night. I would also call back to make sure that he hadn't taken his life. And he would camp out outside of my office. And he did this for months. He didn't know where to turn, what to do. He had left five children back in Nigeria. And he was working nights trying to get money to support his children back there. He had studied at London Bible School, at Luther Theological Seminary. He'd spent half his life in seminary, hoping someday to get a doctorate from Harvard, to go back to Nigeria and train pastors teaching the New Testament. Well, they kicked him out. He withdrew from the university, and he said, Krista, what should I do now? And I said, I'll tell you what I would like you to do. I wrote a letter to an organization in Chicago to secure funding for him. And I said, I want you to write your doctoral dissertation and go home with it, and say to the seminary back home, they didn't give me my degree. I said, however, that if it's a good piece of work, I would like you to turn it into the committee, and I will talk to members of the committee, and I guarantee you they would read it. In a year, he wrote 500 pages. And in March, his degree was awarded. I met with him just before he left to go back to Nigeria. He should have graduated in June, but he did not stay for graduation. He left earlier. And he said to me, he said, I don't care about the paper. I don't care about the diploma. I want to go back home and give God the glory for giving me this doctorate. He earned his doctor's degree in New Testament studies. Today, he is in Nigeria teaching New Testament studies and training pastors. This is one of the examples in which I saw my ministry to internationals as one that God had blessed. I think of a Chinese woman. We picked her up at the airport. And Harvard didn't expect her because her university hadn't confirmed that she was coming. This was actually after Tiananmen Square. But in August, she happened to get out of the country. At Harvard, she had no housing. We put her up in our apartment and worked to get her housing in the university. I remember I had to go to the director of the Yenching Institute to represent her because while she could read and write English very well, she could not speak it. So she said, I want you to speak for me because I cannot speak it very well. So I went and represented her. And I remember a few weeks later, she came to my office and she said, I have to write my first big paper. And I don't know what topic to write on. I took her to Widener Library and I suggested a paper topic. Actually, I suggested writing on the social reforms of Ram Mohan Roy, a 19th century Indian reformer. After she wrote the paper, In fact, on my, I had a faculty ID. I check out books for almost a whole year. So I checked out about a dozen books for her on my card, so she wouldn't have to renew the thing every month. And when she finished the paper, she came to my office, and she said, "I have to present this paper in a seminar, but I don't know where the accents go in every word and how to read it." So she had written a 35-page paper in fine print. I said, "You're not going to read this in 1 hour." And I went through the paper and I crossed off pages and paragraphs and I read it aloud to her. And she was sitting next to me and she was putting in the accents where, as I read the paper to her. Well, at Thanksgiving, she was at my home for dinner with about a dozen other people, and we were going around the table what to give God thanks for. In fact, I'd helped sponsor her husband, who was not allowed to come into the country. And when his turn came, he came a year later, he said, "I give thanks for God." And it was the first time I heard the word God from this Chinese scholar's mouth. And when she was leaving, she handed me an envelope and she said, "I want you to buy some presents for the children." There were $10, $20 bills in the envelope. She said, "You've been so good to me. Use this to buy presents for the children." I spoke to her a couple of days ago, and it is clear to me that God has been working in her life. She's doing a PhD at Harvard in Sanskrit studies. And I shared with her my conversion story, and I told her that I was giving this talk, and she mentioned, she said, "I hope a particular professor does not show up." because she knows how opposed this professor is to me and to what I stand for. But these are just examples of ways my wife and I have worked to help internationals to be a Christian presence, a witness to them of the reality of Christ. I don't have time to tell you about those who have come to Christ, those we have discipled in the faith. That will take too long. I wouldn't even have time to talk about Russia. I see my time is almost up. But yesterday, Saturday at noon, I met with the dean of the Harvard Divinity School. I was going through some old books, trying to figure out what to take to Russia, and I found a sheet of paper in one of the books. And on that sheet of paper, it was a list of people who were admitted to Yale for the PhD in theology. And this was some years back. And on the list, of the 10 names, I saw the dean of Harvard Divinity School at the bottom of the list. And my name was just above his name. He and I were one of the 10 admitted for the PhD at Yale. And he went through the list and he said, "My gosh, only 2 people got their PhD on this list." I said to him, "Well, I actually chose to come to Harvard, and it was the most difficult experience of my life, coming to Harvard to do my PhD in theology. The persecution and the opposition that I encountered really in some ways turned me against the professional study of theology. But by the grace of God, I finished through much tears, trials, and tribulation." Then the dean said to, I told him that I was on my way to, I'm leaving for Moscow in the summer. And he said, "And what is going to happen to the International Student Ministry in the Memorial Church?" I said, "I don't think I will be replaced. That position was created for me, and I'm not sure that it will be filled." He said, "Well, something has to be done about this, because this is such a critical and important ministry to the international community." The dean of the Divinity School recognized that. Well, we are leaving for Moscow in middle August. And we see this as the hand of God. I don't believe that God calls anyone to a task without God preparing you for that. You may feel inadequate, you may feel incompetent, not ready, but I assure you, when God calls, He prepares. And you can look back and see the hand of God leading and guiding and directing. In 1985, in January, my wife and I went to Topsom, Maine for a week's vacation between semester breaks. A friend had moved out of her house, and she said we could have a vacation there. And we decided to spend that week in prayer, waiting on God for directions for our lives. And at the end of that week, we felt God saying to us that we should do two things. One, start a family. You should have a child. And secondly, that Nancy should enroll in Russian. Well, we came back and Nancy enrolled in intensive Russian, a year of Russian at Harvard in one semester. And Jeremy was born in November. And Nancy just felt that she should do this. And since 1985, over the years, she has studied Russian off and on with the children. And we went to Russia in 1991. She won an IREX fellowship funded by the US government. And she did some research in Moscow in Russian art. Harvard Russian Research Center gave her another fellowship last summer to send her. Actually, these fellowships covered the cost of travel for the family. And we went to Moscow last summer again. And at first I thought this was, you know, well, a husband having sometimes to fit into his wife's plans calls for some adjustment and some humility. And she convinced me that there are tremendous doors for ministry for you in Russia. I said, yeah, really? I'll go and see what God has for me. Well, there was really a lot more for me to do than I had imagined. And on many occasions, Nancy was my interpreter when I had to preach and give lectures. I had other Russians doing this as well. But I preached in house churches with 50 to 55 Russians packed in one room to hear the gospel. This was an experience I would never forget. The hunger of these people for the Word of God. Nancy was a guest. Nancy had an affiliation with the Ministry of Culture, with the Institute of Theater, and she made a lot of contacts with the Jewish intelligentsia in Moscow, people in the art and theater world. And we have scores of friends in that world, most of them coming from atheistic backgrounds, but who are open to faith. And we look forward to going there this summer, where I will be professor of Christian studies. People have asked me, well, how are you going to survive in Russia? I expect to take my Russian ruble salary and donate it for the purchase of Christian books, because they desperately need these. I was just reading a book here called Two Worlds, Notes on the Death of Modernity in America and Russia. And I just want to read a few lines to you about what is going on in religion in the academic world in Russia? And why do I see this as important? The writer of this book says, he came to Moscow as a visiting lecturer at Moscow University. Though older faculty members at Moscow University may have once been leading apologists of atheism, most are now hearty advocates of openness in the dialogue about various religious traditions and their social consequences. Actually, what he's saying is that the Department of Atheism, the name has been changed to the Department of the Historical and Scientific Study of Religion and Free Thinking. At Moscow University, it's no longer the Department of Atheism. It is now the Department of the Scientific and Historical Study of Religion and Free Thinking. Various specialists in the department were drawn to issues in the history of religions, church-state relations, political ethics, psychology of religion, and to my surprise, contemporary theology, not only Orthodox, but also Catholic and Protestant theological method and dogmatics. While American secular university departments of religion are busy disavowing theology, ironically, Soviet studies in religion are intensely intrigued by theology proper, theological method, dogmatics, and the history of Christian doctrine. And again here, when Soviet religion professors speak of the scientific study of religion, they mean a scientific frame of reference in which science is still strongly shaped by idiosyncratic Soviet intellectual assumptions. I would describe them as former Marxists still studying religion with categories shaped by Leninist premises. Theories they are now honestly trying to reach beyond. It is my guess that none of the people I met at Moscow State University would view themselves as Christian believers in an explicit sense. But they almost all are intensely interested in Christian belief and are emotively drawn toward it, despite their previous involvement with official atheism. It led me to think that learning Russian and going to the Soviet Union may become a high calling of young scholars in religious studies. I will be officially part of IFES, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, the parent organization of InterVarsity. I've been accepted by them unofficially. Some paperwork still has to be done, but they've assured me that in the next couple of weeks, it should all be taken care of, and they want me to become part of the IFES team in Russia. There are 14 IFES teams in the former Soviet Union. I will be part of the Moscow team, and I see a major part of my ministry as evangelism to Russian faculty at the State University of the Humanities and at other universities where I hope I would be invited to give lectures. I really wanted to go there and teach the history of Christian doctrine, but I was on the phone with members of the department 2 weeks ago, and they want me to teach contemporary theology and in the spring term teach a course on Hinduism, Christianity, and Buddhism, the comparative study of religion. I find this to be very exciting, thrilling, and I just can't wait to get there. So I ask you to pray for us that God would raise the support that we would need to carry out this project. We would be taking our two children. We need housing. We have to find out about schools for the children. And there are a lot of health things that we have to look into, health insurance and other things. I have lost all my benefits, health insurance, and all the benefits that I had with my Memorial Church position. And so we have to do some quick fundraising to make up for the loss of benefits and the stipend which I received from the Memorial Church. And in the couple of months remaining before we go, we pray that God would tie all these loose ends together so that we would go there unencumbered with these concerns. God bless you.